Welcome to Making Sense of MarTech, a podcast about, well, making sense of MarTech. I am your host, the CEO of the MarTech Weekly, Juan Mendoza. Today we are joined by Lauren Maffeo. Lauren is the award-winning service designer working full-time at Steampunk, where she serves the US federal government. She's also the founding editor of Springer's AI and Ethics Journal and an adjunct lecturer of interaction design at the George Washington University. Lauren has written for the Harvard Science Review, the Financial Times, and the Guardian. She's also presented her research on bias in AI at Princeton and Columbia Universities, Google DevFest DC, and Twitter's San Francisco headquarters, and is the author of Designing Data Governance from the Ground Up. Today, we talk about the societal impacts of data governance, the link between human-centered design and managing data in a company, the anti-patterns in data management, the importance of culture in breaking down data silos, balancing transparency with security, and the link between data quality and misinformation, plus so many other topics. And now I bring you Lauren. Hey, Lauren, how you doing?
Hi, Juan. I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, clearly you are credentialed. Looking at your background, you have done a lot of amazing work in AI, data governance, and you have this fascinating overlap with human-centered design principles in your day-to-day work. So you're a public intellectual and academic doing a bunch of great stuff in the industry. But I want to ask you, what's driving a lot of that? Why get into this sort of field of work, and what keeps you in it?
That's an awesome question. And I've been doing quite a few podcasts to help promote Designing Data Governance from the Ground Up, the book I just wrote, and nobody has asked me that. What's driving you? And if I had to distill it down, it goes back a couple of years ago when I was in my role as a research analyst at Gartner at the time. This was about 5 to 7 years ago, when the rhetoric and discourse around AI and automation and this new technology that was coming out to take people's jobs really began to take off in the public media. And I wondered if that was true. I wondered if that was an overreach of sorts. And I wanted to learn more about this technology to see if that was actually the case. While that was occurring, there was a different discourse happening around AI, which was that many of these different techniques that were coming out, such as in products that were in the public sphere, like facial recognition software, were actually biased towards certain groups of users. So one common example is that the automated soap dispensers that we all use in airports and restrooms around the world have historically not worked as well on black and or darker skin.
Oh, okay.
And they don't work as well as they do on white skin. Mm. And again, my curiosity was, why is that the case? And that really began my interest in researching different AI techniques and trends. At that point, I was a research analyst at Gartner covering trends in cloud business intelligence software for small and mid-sized businesses. So this interest dovetailed nicely with my job at the time. And then when I became a service designer as a member of a technical team at Steampunk, I started working more directly with clients, and I saw firsthand how low the data maturity of most organizations is today. This, I already knew this having worked at Gartner, because Gartner produces regular assessments of data maturity based on its surveys of C-suite executives. And what I've noticed over these last several years I mentioned is that the maturity of the average organization when it comes to data remains low, while the volume of data being produced and ingested continues to grow. And so when you ask what drives me, I am a context person. I'm also a why person. So if there is a big problem out there, whether it is AI that is biased against certain groups of users, or whether it is automation that's going to take people's jobs, my question is why. And I also like connecting dots between things. And as a service designer, my job is to be the user advocate on projects. So I see all of this work as a way of advocating for as many user groups as possible, not just one particular privileged type of user.
Yeah, there's so much in that. I mean, the curiosity aspect, you know, why are these things happening? You know, data governance has such a, I would say a brilliant amount of multifaceted issues within that, you know, and we're going to cover a few of those in this conversation. We're going to cover things like the anti-patterns of culture. You know, we're going to talk about misinformation and fake data, data quality and veracity. But those are just a small portion of that holistic picture of how companies manage data. And, you know, you've probably come at the right time, Lauren, historically, I think, you know, because we've been on a good 10 to 15 year track of collecting, particularly from enterprise brands perspective, collecting as much data as possible. And now we're kind of looking at it and going, this is a big pile of stuff. What do we do with that? You know, and so it is fascinating just to hear you say how that curiosity has led you further into AI and into the data governance space. So I want to set the principles for this conversation and kind of get the foundation down before we dive into the details. And so you have this really interesting link between human-centered design and data governance. Perhaps could you start with a definition of what those two things are and how do you see them linked in your practice?
Sure. Human-centered design really is an approach to building products and services that center on a deep understanding of that product or service's core user groups. And the reason that that is important is because one might think that it is automatic for technical teams to design products and services for particular user groups. Even if they do, that does not mean that they've done the discovery, we call it, in design, and the user research to deeply understand those user groups and their unique pain points, as well as what they need and want from those products and services. So that involves someone like me coming into an engagement with a client and working with our stakeholder to figure out who those core user groups are, identifying the right people to speak with in those respective groups, interviewing them effectively to ask about their experience with this product or service. My goal in those conversations is to not only listen and understand their day-to-day, but to pick out where they experience friction so that I can ultimately design a solution that eases or eliminates the friction. To do that, I design a series of assets like user personas, journey maps, service blueprints, which capture their experience using the product or service today, as well as laying out a better path forward. And then on top of that, I work with the users throughout the product life cycle to embed them in usability testing. So once we've designed proofs of concepts and minimum viable products, then I conduct usability testing where I guide them through the solution we've built to see if there is a solution that is meeting their needs. And it really is essential because it is the antithesis of how most organizations build products and services today. I would argue that much of tech today is still built on assumptions about not only who your users are, but how they use your product or service and what they want or need. It also sounds very obvious to say, but you can have diverse user groups of your product or service who use it differently and need different functionality from it. And so my job really is to tease that out for the client and be the user advocate in the room when technical decisions are being made and direction is being set.
Mm. You know, it is an interesting aspect to this is that a lot of companies think about human-centered design from the perspective of their customer, you know, so we're doing UX, we're designing interfaces and products and services for our customers. However, increasingly, and I found this actually a lot in my own consulting work, is that there is so much design thinking in internal products and internal alignment and services, like more than I actually ever thought. I often would say, you know, we would design a workshop, say it'd be a, you know, customer journey mapping workshop as an example. But what we're actually doing, if we're getting, you know, six different teams of stakeholders together and they all have different views and different ways of approaching stuff, is as you design the workshop, you're actually designing it as its own product to get to an outcome. an outcome, maybe a plan exactly. or a strategy or a business case, you know. So there's so much internal in large organizations, particularly with the federal government in the US. I can imagine there's so much design you need to do internally within those organizations for the business users.
Exactly. And I love that you brought up the workshop aspect, because that is another key aspect of the work. It is not just engaging the users of a product or service, but then you also have to engage your stakeholders and your client to co-create that solution, which would better serve the user's needs and desires. And a huge part of human-centered design does center on that principle of co-creation and that concept, because the reality is that none of us like having things forced on us from a top-down approach, especially without a rationale that relates to us and our work. Otherwise, it just feels like disruption for its own sake. And you can design and build the best solution in the world. If nobody uses it, it's pretty useless. And so a big part of human-centered design involves engaging the right user groups to listen to them and assess their needs. It also involves engaging your stakeholders to co-create a better path forward that is not going only to benefit their users, but to benefit them as well. And when you co-create the solution, then you are more easily able to get the buy-in that you need. It does not mean that it will be easy, because people inherently have different priorities. There is inherent friction in even the healthiest organizations. I would argue that the healthiest organizations have friction because you have a diverse range of leaders with diverse experiences and needs, desires, et cetera. So it is certainly not easy work, but that co-creation with your stakeholders through workshops and designing solutions that benefit the user groups is really essential.
This topic is fascinating to me, because the difference between designing for customers and designing for internal business users is like orange and apples, chalk and cheese, like completely different. Why? It's because the incentives are different. You know, when you're designing for your customer, they're buying something or participating in something, and they want to get, they're exchanging, usually in most cases, they're exchanging money or attention for some outcome. But when you're designing internally, and I would love your thoughts on this, on what incentives you see, but I see often, you know, and going back to my work in consulting, you know, my manager years ago when I was a junior would say to me, your job is to get the head of marketing promoted, right? Like, so it's a very different set of incentives. You've got people who in different teams that have their own incentives within an organization, that have their own OKRs or their KPIs or name whatever acronym measurement you want to name. But, you know, they've got their own measurement that they're trying to achieve. They've got their own incentives in terms of career progression, remuneration, all of that, you know, and then you have a dynamic that has executive teams, middle management, and then you've got like the doers and the people that are actually executing the work, which all have their own contexts and their own sense of what's happening in a business from a reality standpoint. And so, like, could you unpack that a bit? Like, when you do the HCD work in this data governance space, do you think about incentives a lot? What does that look like?
I think about incentives every day, because I think if you want to understand why people in any situation act the way they do, look at how they're rewarded. It really is that simple. If people are not incentivized to do particular tasks, they won't do them. You can say as much as you want that they should do X, Y, Z because it's the right thing to do or the virtuous thing to do. But if you are not giving them tangible rewards for that work that feed their internal motivations, they're not going to do it. And that's a big part of what I discuss in the book. There's a chapter devoted to data stewardship, explaining what it is and why it's valuable, as well as the different functions that data stewards serve. And the short version of the chapter is to say that data stewards are your subject matter experts of your respective data domains in your organization. So for instance, if your data domains are sales, marketing, and customer success, you want to look for the most senior leaders in those key areas, which are who are the closest to the data, know the most about it, can give crucial context to the data in those domains, and can then contribute to a shared resource like a data dictionary that lives in your data architecture so that they are involved in co-creating the standards for instance, the marketing data in the marketing data domain. I would argue that the leader of the marketing data domain should have a hand in defining what quality marketing data looks like. But if you ask the marketing data director or CMO to serve as a data steward and do not give them anything in return, good luck, because they are already overworked. They already have a lot on their plates. And if you cannot let them know how this work will improve their own, they're not going to add that additional work to their plates. They really have to not only see data stewardship as crucial to their own success, you as the data leader also have to figure out tangible ways to reward them and acknowledge their work in this effort, especially in the beginning.
I always say that if it's, particularly for enterprise, if it's number two on the to-do list, it ain't going to happen. You know, if you're
that's
asking them
accurate
to approve
that's
something, or, you know, yeah, to review something or to make some sort of action, if it ain't number one, it's not just that, like the amount of times things just fall by the wayside or they sit in a Scrum Kanban backlog and you just look at it every stand up and you go, oh yeah, that's there. We'll never do it. You know, I'm being a little bit cynical, but it just, you're right that the incentives of like, how are people rewarded is what, unfortunately, you know, people don't work from altruism in business, you know, well, maybe in the US government, because of course it's the government or nonprofits, it's a bit different perhaps, but the incentives of, yeah, like the hard levers of recognition, remuneration, promotion, and, you know, and perhaps even better quality work is, those are just the main levers to get people to do things. It just sounds a bit coarse, but it just seems like a reality.
It is a reality. And I would also reiterate what you said about the user base being internal to an organization versus external users. When it comes to that specific question, who are your users and are they in your organization or outside the organization? I've worked with clients in both scenarios. And in my experience, having your users be part of your client's organization is drastically harder because then politics enter the picture really quickly. People very often, when you report out on the results of your user interviews, it's very common for stakeholders to say who said that or to even demean them in some cases, try to figure out who they are. And so the politics enter the picture much faster when your user groups are internal to your organization. There are also inherent power dynamics that come out really quickly. And so that scenario is much more challenging from the service design perspective than if your users are outside of the organization.
Mm-hmm. Is there a aspect to this where agreeableness and not being agreeable are like factors in how things get done? So maybe I'll unpack that a little bit. So being agreeable means that you're happy to go with the direction that's been set. You know, say you're running a workshop, and if you're an agreeable person, you say, yeah, I'm just going to go along with the activities and don't criticize them, you know, and really just go along with the work and the strategy and the movement of the business. That's kind of being agreeable. And what you're saying, which I'm kind of picking up on, is people that are not agreeable are people that are very like to embrace conflict. They like to obviously stir things up, and sometimes they'll disagree for no reason at all, you know, just to be that devil's advocate. It seems that those people can often poison the well. You know, there's like one bad actor within a group and organization that kind of makes the whole group less easy to work with purely by virtue of they're just not as agreeable. But I don't know if that's the right definitions, but to me, I've seen that pattern a lot where you have one person that just makes the entire process of saying, you know, for example, a customer journey workshop, going back to that, there's one person that will make everything 10 times more difficult purely by virtue of being disagreeable or not working, say, in good faith or charitably.
That's exactly it. My colleague just today was talking about a time when she led a stakeholder workshop to do various design exercises that would promote strategic thinking and strategy planning. She said that one person walked out of the sessions, and that when this person did so, the rest of the room breathed a sigh of relief and yes. effectively said, "Oh, great, we can finally do the work now." And in my experience, there is always, you can always count on at absolute bare minimum one person in your stakeholder group who is going to resist the change you're introducing. The reality is that the number is probably much higher than one, but yes. there is always someone who has vested interest in maintaining the status quo. And the reasons for that depend on the circumstances, but there is, no matter how horrible your tech stack is, no matter how much you lack a wider strategy, no matter how long it's been since your interface was redesigned, I guarantee you there's somebody in that organization who has a vested interest in keeping things the same. And that person is who you need to watch out for, because they're going to be a stick in the mud. It is almost always not your product owner or core project or sponsor/client. Sometimes it is, but it's very often they've hired you to implement the change. But there is, again, always somebody in my experience who is there to resist the change. And that is a very difficult battle to overcome. And that's why the change management aspect of human-centered design is so real and important, because you can, again, introduce the best change in the world to an organization. You can introduce the right change for user groups. But if it is not communicated effectively, and if it is not rolled out in a way that resonates with the people being affected, it is not going to go anywhere.
Yeah. So that's the one side. And you know, we're getting into this territory of anti-patterns, you know. So when you're managing data in an organization, you're trying to make change around your governance, there's all these anti-patterns. And one of those is either the domineering boss that everyone, you know, breathes a sigh of relief when they're out the room, you know, or the person that's deliberately not wanting to change the status quo and resist any sort of change or conversation. But then there's the other side of this, which is the imposter syndrome side, the insecurity aspect of this, of people not feeling like they can contribute to a conversation, or that they could actually take on the work, or feeling outright like frauds, you know, in the actual competencies of doing this kind of work. And I think that, and in the industry, I see a lot of that, because data is not something that we've handed down from generations. You know, we are working with new materials, new subject matter that in our generation is so novel and new. So you're going to have a lot of people just not feeling competent or comfortable to actually contribute to conversations or be part of that change. Do you see that as well? Is the other side of this more this sort of insecurity aspect of getting teams to work together?
I absolutely do. When it comes to data governance and data in general, I am more convinced the longer I do this work that nobody knows what they're doing. And that is a little scary maybe, but I hope it does give some relief to those who feel imposter syndrome, because it's very easy when you're in a room to think that you're the only one feeling a certain way. You're the only person who doesn't know what a particular data definition means. You're the only one who doesn't know what metadata is. The reality is that even if other people in the room do have the knowledge you lack, they do not have knowledge that you possess. And when it comes to data, you know, I mentioned earlier, I think I said something in my first answer to the effect of there was this new technology called AI. AI is not new. It has been around for decades in some form. It is always evolving. It is not new. What is new is the volume of data that is being produced and ingested today. That is something that no one, regardless of how long you've been in the business, this is not something that people have dealt with before. This is a new problem, even if AI itself is not new. And so everyone is collectively trying the best way forward to figure it out. And I am a critic of the move fast and break things mantra that is common in Silicon Valley, because it does result in a lot of harm when you ship. I think it's really important to have a sandbox environment and a, you know, dev environment and keep them separate. You do need an environment where you can experiment with new technologies and figure out the best path forward so that you can ship more thoughtfully. The danger and the anti-pattern comes in when you have this culture of tinkering for its own sake or shipping for its own sake. I mean, we know, if you work in tech, you know that there is a large number of people in the developer community who admit to shipping bad code because they are incentivized to ship regardless of the quality or how clean the code is. So then you think about code, and then I am not aware of similar surveys and research as it pertains to data and releasing, you know, bad data into algorithms, but I can assure you that the problem is 10 times worse than bad code, because data is a lot more complicated than code. And the quality checks are just not there. They're still being implemented and they're being implemented piecemeal. And I think a big reason for that is that I've given this a lot of thought, and the tech world writ large, and then the data world as a subset of that, really lacks a cohesive set of values and ethics and standards, which all technologists abide by. And that's actually quite rare. So if you are a lawyer, or you work in medicine, if you work in accounting, yes, the specifics of the ethics might change depending on the country, region, et cetera. But if you work in law, medicine, or accounting, you take an oath that you are beholden to a set of industry standards that everyone is in the profession is aware of, and your success at your job depends on doing that work according to those ethics. If you don't, you are subject to severe consequences. And so you effectively take this oath to do no harm to your clients and your patients. And we are so far from, we're on the complete opposite side of the spectrum in tech with data. And yep. we have all of the, now I feel like we're in the same problem space as we are with content, where there is way too much content out there in the world today. And there we have likewise so many different frameworks and standards for data that are flying around all over the place, but we do not have that universal set of standards that we as tech professionals are beholden to. And I think we're really suffering the consequences for that.
Have you by chance, we're recording this episode on the 19th of October, but have you had a chance to read the recent essay that just came out of A16Z? So Mark Andreessen over there, he's just written a 5,000 word screed on techno optimism. Have you had a chance to check that out just yet?
I have not. I'm pretty sure I saw his name trending on Twitter earlier this week, and I was not sure why. So I have not read it. Yeah. What did it say?
So I'm sure you remember years ago when A16Z put out this article that basically gave them their thesis, which is software's eating the world, you know. And yes. So that was that sort of famous, you know, software is, you know, Uber has no, they own no cars, Airbnb owns no hotels, you know, software is eating the world. But this techno optimism piece is actually a direct contradiction of what you're saying. You're saying that technology lacks ethical, moral frameworks for how it interacts with society. And I agree with that. But Mark Andreessen says that, no, that's only going to slow us down. You know? And that's only going to add more bureaucracy and slow down the pace of innovation in technology. And his argument beneath that, his presupposition, is that society gets better. We become wealthier. We become more secure. We become better as society when technology progresses. So that's sort of his main presupposition there, which we could challenge that all day long. But it is fascinating to see that, you know, there's this techno optimism sort of movement in Silicon Valley right now, with this growing movement of, effective accelerationism, which is the same thesis, basically saying, that no, we don't need to slow down and think about what technology is doing to society. We need to build more technology, right? We just need to keep going, you know, and don't slow down the pace of change or innovation. And, you know, I've literally just started reading it this week. It's a long piece and I'm obviously going to do some work on thinking about it and how it's influencing the next generation of tech entrepreneurs and data leaders. But I do think that, to your point, we are like tech, if you're a developer, if you're a software developer, if you're a consultant, if you're a somebody who works in investing into technology companies, you can't say you have a profession, because a profession is a role, a job that abides by an oath. To your point, you know, if you're a doctor or a lawyer or you're a nurse, those are professions because you profess to a Hippocratic oath or a body of standards that society agrees upon for that practice of work. Technology's never had that. And so can we call ourselves professionals without having that oath? I think that's a fantastic question to ask as we get to the maybe the dark side of what technology is doing to society today.
So there's a lot to unpack there. And again, I have not read his essay yet. The argument, as you describe it, is fascinating to me for a couple of reasons. One of them is this apparent idea that having any set of industry standards is juxtaposed with innovation and that they are diametrically opposed to each other. That very mindset is why we are in this situation. That mindset is what drove Meta to just to use fake information across the platform during very serious election periods. It is what is driving the, I would argue, downfall of Twitter right now. It is what drives the release of facial recognition software that miscategorizes people and gets them falsely arrested. The examples of why that is a harmful attitude are numerous at best. You no longer need to prove that technology like AI has adverse effects. The results of that are obvious. And it's also interesting to me, then there's this idea that you do not have a profession if you're not beholden to a set of industry standards. And that is something that I also find interesting. Like I said, I have not read this article, so I can't profess to have an opinion on the article itself. But I do think that this idea that we are gonna not be as effective as we could as an industry if you do have standards for what you're building is a joke, if I'm being honest. Yeah. And that's especially true when it comes to data. So yeah. I'll use a more, you know, I used external industries like law, medicine, and accounting to make that point about industry standards, but I'll keep it within the tech sector. I don't know a single product manager who would say, I will figure out my go-to-market strategy and write the roadmap after we push to production.
Yes.
But I have had several C-suite client data clients say to me, we'll do data governance after production. Mm. And even within the tech world, there is no other sector of tech that is as free to do what they want as data. And that actually, in my opinion, disproves the entire point that having standards would slow folks down, because we are letting people do whatever they want with data right now. And look where we're at. There are consequences of that behavior. Now, some people will think that the consequences of not of the standards and oaths that we might take, some people might think that having that would make us worse, but the entire point is that we are in what is professed to be a golden age of tech. If your idea of a golden age is to let people do whatever the heck they want with data, we're already there. And yet I'm on your show in part to talk about the consequences of that. So your actions have consequences, and it's really a question of which ones you choose.
Yeah, there is a lot in that. And I think that the principle I go back to is when it comes to data and data management is that it's not like we use so many words to obfuscate just realities in how data is used and managed in our world today. You know, we'll say, oh, we're being regulated. Or, you know, there is, you know, all of this data that we're using for targeting, you know, and when I look at these kind of words, they obfuscate the reality that data is about safety. It's about people knowing that they're safe. If you have ever been in a situation where you've been hacked and you've lost your credit card details or your, for example, my wife last year, there was a major data breach in a telecommunications company, and she had to go and exchange her license to get a new one because her license details were exposed. You know, like data is about safety, and it's about making people feel safe and know that their data is secure. But that is the foundational principle that I go to often, that a lot of when we talk about data is obfuscation when we're actually talking about making it safe and secure and obviously usable for productive purposes. Those are the things that are most important. You know, if you're a business and you're thinking about managing, governing your data, think less about governance and think about safety, right? How do you create a safe environment? Because data can lead to huge amounts of harm. And I think it is quite naive to think that, you know, as you point out with the example, is that, you know, you'll ship a product and then think about the data governance later. You know, like data is about safety. And I think that's sort of one of the central points here. But I want to talk a little bit about more of the sort of practical aspect of doing this work, Lawrence. So you've been doing it for quite a while. Obviously, you've written a fantastic book about it. What are some of the great principles that you bring into building strong data governance in a way that's thoughtful? Is culture a big part of that, or, you know, other areas that people should be looking at when thinking about data governance?
I would say that that culture is the foundation of data governance. It is fundamentally a culture shift in your organization more than it is a technical initiative. And that's because your culture and the culture you create around data governance determines which tools you buy, which staff you hire, which colleagues you engage. Everything about your approach to data governance sends a huge signal about your culture and what that culture values. And likewise, I think the biggest thing that you can do to get started with data governance is to ask two questions. Why does my company exist, and how are we using data to fulfill that mission? That gets very high level. And when I ask C-suite leaders this question, I get a fascinating range of responses depending on where they work. So nonprofits, for instance, have very clear, succinct mission statements. They have to, because they have to prove that they have a reason for existing. There are many commercial brands which also have very succinct statements of value. And then the question becomes, once you have that statement of value written out and it's very clear for all of your customers, the people you serve and the public, how are you using data today in a way that fulfills that mission? And you would be surprised how long it takes many people to link those two things together. There is a fundamental disconnect between the mission of most organizations and how those organizations use data to fulfill that mission. Until there is more collaboration between those two sides of the organization, I don't think we're going to make much progress, because the fundamental disconnect is that the data practices and strategies of most organizations are not fulfilling this bigger business need. And the consequences of that are enormous. They include not inviting data scientists and the chief data officer to the table. They include not understanding fundamentally the role of the data team. The consequences include people in data roles, whether it's data engineering, data science, not doing a great job of, you know, they can talk to you all day long about data science and which techniques they're using, but they cannot explain how that work is enhancing the business they work for. And so until you really get clear on not only why your organization exists, but your data practices help fulfill that mission, you will not make progress and you will continue to stall out. Also, that's essential because the fundamentals of designing data governance involve creating cross-functional coalitions and teams of data stewards who can help you in your efforts. That's what it means to create a data-driven culture. And if you cannot rally everyone around a common goal, you will only get so far. So it's really important to get clear on what you're doing and why. And that's why the main group of readers for the book I wrote is data leaders in organizations, whether it's the CDO, whether it's the data director, whether it's the head of data science. The book was written for people who are the heads of data in their organizations, meaning it's their job to come up with the strategy to manage the people, processes, and tools that will steward the data in that organization. And so fundamentally, it is their job to get everybody in alignment. And that is the audience this book is aimed at.
Yeah. That alignment piece is super important. I mean, I've been reading increasingly studies that say that that particularly from a marketing perspective, that performance data is pretty accessible these days. You know, how your campaigns are going, you know, what's the status of your customers, what's their lifetime value churn. But when it comes to disseminating that information to different silo teams within marketing, you know, say you have your performance marketing or advertising folks, you have your CRM and loyalty people, maybe you have an experimentation, personalization stream of work within a business, you know, like all of those different teams are seeing different shades of data. You know, it is interesting because there is a element of that the data reflects the reality of a business, you know, so it's commercial status, it's the state of its customers, the state of the experience of the users, you know, all data facilitates the reality making within a company, you know. And do you see that, like, there's often when it doesn't work out that people start getting funny ideas about their customers because they just don't have that, like, that shared sense of that ground truth and reality of this is what our data is saying about our business and our customer?
Oh, I do see that. And my clients see it as well. I've had clients tell me that they hesitate to share particular types of data with senior leadership because doing so would expose how immature their data practices are. And I had a data analyst tell me once that when he is giving data to anyone who requests it higher up, he says, I've done the best I can to give you accurate data based on the resources I have and our data practices. But until those improve, the data quality is what it is, so to speak. And in other words, this is my best guess, but the organization is not doing enough to take this data usage to the next level that will improve its quality. And so that's why I say you need to get really clear on creating a cultural mandate around data governance, but you also need to really get people clear on the state of data today. And that is in many ways the hardest part, because doing that introspective work of assessing the current state often leads to perceived negative results. And the reality is this assessment of your data practices today really is just, it's just information. And the challenge really comes in when you choose not to be honest about where you're at and move forward. Because once you are honest about the state of things today, you can start designing solutions for a better tomorrow. You can use your budget more effectively. You can engage the right people. But until you really take a hard look at how things are, you're not going to improve.
Yeah. There is almost an epistemological aspect to this, you know. It's the work of data governance is almost the work of reality making within companies. And I don't know if that's the right link to make, but it is a fascinating way of thinking about the power of data for insight within a company and how just disastrously wrong it can become, you know, like the problems of not having that right data. And I think increasingly, customers are actually wanting to know their data as well. They want to know what's being collected, what's being shared. They want to delete their data completely from a company. Increasingly, the European Data Commission is making that concrete rules and laws now that companies need to adhere to a standard of practice for data deletion and transparency over what's being tracked about them. You know, and if we look at the internal business situation, you mentioned earlier that it's been a bit of a free-for-all, a wild, wild west. Do whatever you want internally. But if you look out in the marketplace, third-party cookies has been the poster child of the wild, wild west. You can do whatever you want. And consumers are increasingly being concerned about that. Latest Pew research say that I think it's more than 80% of consumers are concerned about what's going on with the data that's being collected about them online. So there is this challenge around, well, if data governance is reality making internal companies and customers want to understand what's being collected about them, how do businesses approach that? What's the connection between transparency and balancing, I guess, the security and risk of sharing data with consumers or giving them the ability to see what's being collected about them? Is that a false equivalence? Or I'm kind of curious to see what you think about transparency and data security. How do you think companies should be approaching that data transparency aspect, particularly with their customers?
I think they can approach data transparency with customers through a few ways. One is to have a charter, so to speak, for how you manage and store consumer data. And many organizations do not want to be transparent about that, given the practices themselves, which I think says something. But that is something that you can do to build transparency. And part of what I advocate for in the book is writing a charter for your data governance council, which is comprised of your core data stewards, who are the subject matter experts across domains, so that you are defining the purpose of the council, what your mandate is for what you want to work on, and then the core principles you're going to cover. You also need documentation for your environment. You need to let everybody on your team know which data lives where so that they can access it easily. You also need to do that hard work of building the right data architecture from the beginning in order to be more strategic about linking the right tools, building the right integrations between those tools, because one of the huge problems I see today is that data lives everywhere in organizations, and it often originates in flat files on colleagues' laptops. Yeah. And so then people can't access the data that they need, let alone have it beholden to a uniform set of standards. Mm. And then finally, on top of all of that, you really need to make a plan to govern data throughout your product lifecycle. If you are using more advanced AI techniques, you know that production is and hitting production is really only the beginning, because you are going to be having those models ingest data repeatedly. That is going to affect the quality of the model, and it can affect it for better, but it can also affect it for worse. So getting very clear on what you're doing, documenting it, and keeping it in specific places that are easily accessible, whether it's on a public platform like GitHub or your internal Confluence page, is really crucial.
Mm. So there's an aspect to this where you create a charter. So you get clarity over what data is living where, and then that kind of sets your guardrails for how individual employees may use data. You know, what's incredible is that even in enterprise, so much customer data is just sitting in Excel sheets on somebody's desktop. You know, it's actually, if you use a physical analog to it, imagine having like rows and rows and rows of sensitive documents just scattered on your desk, you know, and like, that's kind of the same thing here, right? Like, you're storing it in a physical location and people can't access it. And it's just sitting there. And what do you do with that? The employee leaves, or they, you know, often it's so easy to transfer data out of your work laptop into your personal, you know. So there's all of these. And then don't get me started about smartphones. Like, my goodness, what a data security challenge that is, right? Like, seeing stuff, like accessing documents and spreadsheets on your smartphone or your laptop or your tablet device. You know, so how do you solve that? That seems just an impossible problem to solve, is that Yeah, people are just going to say stuff to their computer. And what does that do to governance and security? Yeah.
I mean, that's storing stuff on your personal devices is a whole other area. If organizations feel strongly about that, then they do need to write it into their standards for employees, which they probably should. The reality is that most organizations do have policies of that nature because they legally have to. That is an area where there are legal mandates. You cannot store client data on your personal devices, for instance, and you can't store certain types of client data on even your work devices. So for instance, if your client issues you a laptop that they own, that is their property, and you can only access certain data systems by using that particular laptop, not your main work laptop. So if that is important to leaders, they do need to have policies on that.
Yeah. It is one of the challenging things is that data is like a leaky bucket in most organizations. It's just all over the place and everywhere. But mm-hmm. you're right that like guardrails, having not just, I guess, a set of rules within organizations, but also real consequences, you know, goes to the top of this conversation. Incentives really matter. And so, you know, having the right incentives for, you know, the healthy use of data and defining that properly, and then also the disincentives for folks that, you know, may not be using the data appropriately. But, you know, we're getting close to the end of our conversation here, but I've kind of left the best for last. I mean, one of the fascinating topics and the thing that you, I think, are uniquely as a thinker, Lauren, are doing right now is making this link between the mismanagement of data, data governance as a concept, and the societal problems like misinformation. I mean, can you help make that link for me? Like how does data governance impact things like misinformation online?
That's a great question. So one example of it, I think the clearest example I can think of is the impact of Facebook on a range of societal challenges that we've seen. The biggest one that is relevant to me, given my status as an American living in Washington, D.C., was the amount of misinformation on Facebook that was spread by users in countries like Russia during the 2016 presidential election. And the reality is that it goes back to what I said about how are you rewarding people and how are you rewarding companies, because the reality is Facebook doesn't care if their platform spreads misinformation. They care about engagement, and we've learned over time that content which stirs people up and makes them angry is most likely to get engagement. And so then they're not incentivized to stop the spread of misinformation on their platform, because ultimately it results in ad revenue, which drives up their stock and keeps shareholders happy. Facebook is now a very commercial enterprise, and that is what it's incentivized to do, to make money for stakeholders. And so that it goes back to how are you motivating organizations and what drives them? They can say all they want that they want to connect the world and that's their driving force. But ultimately, when you look at what's under the hood, they exist to make money and will do that through any legal means possible. And so that's one of many examples of how data and the data that we give these bigger organizations has really far-reaching consequences beyond our own lives.
Yeah. So I think the link there is actually the incentives, isn't it? It's the incentives between, okay, how does your organization align your data to your values? And then what does the externalities of that into the marketplace? I mean, you know, the social media platforms are obviously one of the the easiest examples to spot, but there are other examples where that the data governance, or like what you're using data for, what's the incentives, leads to negative consequences. I'm sure there's plenty of other examples out there, you know, but like I think about search often, you know, and how often people, I look at search and it's how much it's degraded over time because the incentives for the data management has increasingly swung to the advertisers. And so if you search something on Google now, you're getting 7, 8, almost a full page of ads, and then maybe a few organic links. You know, that
right.
clearly is a misalignment in incentives and how that data is being governed. But you know, that has repercussions, because increasingly, you know, the information you're seeing on Google that you rich people rely on to find things is influenced by advertisers, you know. And I don't want to even get into the SEO industry and how much it's impacted, you know, the flow of information, but I can see that link in other areas as well. But outside of social, what kind of other areas have you seen that the values or the incentives of data governance impacting certain externalities?
That's a broad question. I think the reality is that it's all around us. I mean, and one of the biggest examples is just broadly speaking, that bad data management and lack of governance does impede the user experience. Facebook, as going back to that example, is getting very wealthy as an organization because of its current data practices. They're doing so at the expense of the user experience. I would challenge anybody listening to this to name one person other than an older relative of theirs who enjoys going on Facebook. It's kind of understood that going on there is not a pleasant experience because of the environment that Facebook has fostered for at the expense of its users. And similarly, even when I talk to users of data environments, even if they know how to hack the system, even if they know Python and can use Jupyter notebooks and can manipulate systems to get the data that they need, the average user cannot. And so we are mismanaging data at the user's expense. And I mean that the user very broadly. Until we go back to truly putting their needs first and aligning what they need to an organizational mission, we're not going to make progress. And by the way, that is not to say that you can't make money. I mean, if you are a commercial enterprise of any sort, you need to sell goods, services, et cetera, to make money. So this is not about demonizing money or making a living or anything of that sort, but it really does go back to what's your motivation and who do you care about the most? I think many organizations today have proven through their data management that they care more about their shareholders than they care about their users. Those are often not the same groups of people. And until they get real about that, we won't see a lot of improvement.
Yeah. Right now we are talking in the context of a huge hype bubble in generative AI, you know, and what we're talking about here, I think, comes to the heart of the data and how it's governed and how it's managed has a huge impact. I mean, I'm looking, you know, even today, I've been looking at videos of men with towels on their heads using generative AI to portray themselves as women, you know. And you look at that, and that's just data. All underneath that, the ability to create deep fake videos and imagery, the ability to create text and generate and copy that is like almost as good as humans can write, even sometimes better. All of those things are the underpinnings is data. OpenAI has data governance principles, I'm sure, and they've used their data in a way to create these generative AI platforms. Same with other tools like platforms like Google and Meta. They've also got their own AI systems, you know, Anthropic and you know, there's many others. However, the way I'm thinking about this is that, you know, if data governance is reality making and then the incentives increasingly becomes more generative or more fake, if you can say that, that leads to a huge consequence to society. I mean, can you even trust anything online? You know, that's kind of where we get to. Is this like postmodernism concept where the imagery, the photos, the things you see online, you just cannot trust it because it just could be generated by AI. And so we're in this very interesting time of acceleration I think more pressing than ever to think about, you know, how data governance should really be living at the heart of almost any commercial strategy. You know, it is actually pretty incredible. But you know, as we round out, I did want to get your view because you are an AI researcher, you've done a lot of work in AI. What has been your sense of out over the past 12 months with generative AI and all of these new products and services coming to the market?
I think the vast majority of organizations today do not have the maturity with their data to use generative AI tools effectively, at least not in a business context. And they certainly need to be careful about feeding any information into generative AI tools. As one example, I conduct user interviews as part of my job, and that involves the work of not only recording the conversations, but trying to take notes while I'm interviewing users. And then I need to reread the transcripts and write down more notes to make sure I captured everything correctly. I would love, in theory, to outsource that task to generative AI. I cannot do that because of the information that I would be feeding it. I would be feeding it proprietary, not just proprietary information. I mean, I would be feeding it information that could, in some cases, get me sent to prison. And so the reality is that most organizations can't use these tools to the degree that they would like. If you do, I mean, I'm a big open source contributor and believer, but if you have proprietary content, you cannot be giving it to generative AI. And so I think that the rush to adopt these tools is emblematic of the fact that we haven't begun to address, let alone solve, the root problem, which is a lack of data quality standards and governance.
Yes. And values, like real principles, like thinking not just commercially, not just about growth, but thinking clearly about your ethical, moral framework. And I think that's kind of a great place to finish our conversation here, is that data governance has so much to do with your values and what your values are and how you bring that into your business and into the broader online economy. So Lauren, thank you for joining me. What a fascinating conversation. I do want to give you a little bit of a shout out to your book. So the book is called Designing Data Governance from the Ground Up. Highly recommend you go pick that up and read it if you are thinking about data governance. You can find it at PragProg. It's probably the easiest place you can find it. So pragprog.com. You can also find it at amazon.com and Barnes & Noble as well. But Lauren, over to you. If we want to interact or ask questions or continue this conversation, where can we find you online?
So I am online under my full name. So if folks want to connect with me on LinkedIn, I'm there under my name, Lauren Maffeo. I am happy to continue the conversation there. I do still have my Twitter profile, although I'm on there less often. And I would love for folks to buy the book and let me know what they think by writing reviews online. So if folks would be interested in purchasing the book, you can get it in print, e-reader, and audio formats. So many different types of formats. And I would love to hear what people think of it by writing reviews. I always say that a second edition is not out of the question, and I'm looking for things that I might have missed. So I would love to hear from practitioners in this space to learn what resonated and also what I might have missed for a possible update.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Lauren. We regularly interview people at the forefront of the industries, people like Lauren, who are thinking deeply about data governance, AI, and morals and ethics in the online landscape. The people that are featured every week on the martechweekly.com. You can go there to subscribe and stay updated with our podcast. But if you also want to give us a review, we would love that. If you got a little bit of value out of this conversation, if it's given you something to think about, we'd love for you to leave a review, a star review, and a comment on Apple Podcasts. For now, you can read and subscribe at themartechweekly.com. Thanks again for joining us, Lauren.
Thanks for having me. It was really a great conversation.